Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadelsky, with my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadelsky Jr., super endocrinologist. We today have our special guest. He's coming back for a second time to kind of give an update on the topic, Dr. Jesse Richards. He went to the school of OSU down in Oklahoma, Okie State. Now he's a, what are you? Are you a professor or assistant professor? What the heck are you now?
So, okay. I like to tell everybody I'm an equal opportunity Oklahoman. Anyone that's from around here will get that. I went to OU for undergrad, OU for medical school. I'm on faculty at OU now at the School of Community Medicine, doing obesity medicine with the internal medicine program. And I do research with OSU. So I'm an equal opportunity, although I will say we all dislike Texas.
Very good. Well, so last time he was on, we talked about some of the genetics of obesity, going into some of the syndromes, which he is an expert on. And we're going to do an update because he was just the second author on a new update of the criteria for BBS, Bardet-Biedl syndrome. I used to say Biedl, but I heard you say Biedl, so I don't know.
Oh, really? I think I said Biedl.
So it depends on how European you are and who the first person you heard say it. Pronounced it like
just like semaglutide versus semaglutide and
tirzepatide
and
we had a whole thing about that.
Yeah, yells on a chalkboard when I hear all of the different semaglutide pronunciations.
Yeah, I trust us. I know. Okay. So can you give us a brief of a recap of BBS, and we're going to kind of get into some of the genetics of other things, but we're going to specifically talk about BBS.
Okay, so BBS is an autosomal recessive ciliopathy. It's mainly due to dysfunctions in one of the main engines that drives cellular transport and drives changes in the primary cilia on cell surface. So it's involved in like receptors, neurotransmitters, vesicles, big picture stuff.
What the hell are cilia?
So cilia are tiny projections that actually extend out from the cell surface, and they are a way that the cell it basically takes G protein coupled receptors, moves them out there,
and they're going into the...
with different.
No, they're like little hair. They help transport. Go pull it back a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, we got normal people listening, not the.
All right. So not the cell biology level. Okay.
No.
Step back. So look. Cilia move. They're a part of your cell that moves. They are responsible for cells sticking together, cells transmitting messages to each other. The classic example, just from like a layer basic biology perspective, is that sperm have cilia that are highly motile, and that's the like wiggling back and forth is how they swim.
And suddenly Jesse just figured out how to get everyone's attention. Perfect.
Very good.
As you might expect, one of the side effects of having severe ciliary dysfunction in some of these genetic syndromes is going to be fertility issues. So there's a whole slew of organ manifestations. Pretty much if you have an organ system in your body, it's probably, if it has a metabolically active component, it probably has something that can be affected by this. The main thing that we think about in Bardet-Biedl syndrome as compared to some of the other monogenic obesities, which is just, you have a bad gene, you have obesity, but maybe you don't have all these syndromic features, is that there will be organ involvement. So in BBS, the classic thing is you're going to see retinal issues. So you're going to have eye issues, specifically retinal dystrophy. This can present in a various number of manifestations, but typically starts in early childhood to early adolescence, progresses fairly rapidly. And then unfortunately, probably about 70% of people are going to with this condition are going to end up being legally blind. Then additionally, we have post-axial polydactyly. So you're like, that's a nice fancy Latin term you got there. So what basically means is you have extra fingers. So it's typically going to be post-axial meaning on the pinky side. So you're going to have either one, two, or I've had patients that have 24 digits. So they have an extra one on both of their feet and both of their hands.
Mm.
So another hallmark symptom is going to be relatively early onset obesity. Birth weight's normal, but then usually between the age of like 1 to 5, there'll be increased rates of hunger, increased food intake. You start to see the weight trajectory going up. And so that's been in the original and guidelines since the original. It's obesity past age 2, or if they're really early onset, overweight before then. You also see neurocognitive issues. It traditionally, this was considered as a sort of like a severe cognitive impairment. However, it turns out that it's really hard to do well on cognitive evaluations when you're blind. Mm. And that the actual cognitive impairment, probably most of the people with BBS are in the relatively normal distribution. They probably just have more narrow learning difficulties. There's a pretty good explanation for it in that the actual guidelines, it's a little bit outside of my lane. But the other big thing, and this is something that can really show up a lot in the medical side, is that you'll have a lot of kidney or reproductive issues. So with males, you get a hypogonadism, you can have genital abnormalities. So basically structures aren't in the right spot. So like cryptorchidism, you can have micropenis, you can have that just primary hypogonadism, which is you have the normal anatomy, but there's something dysfunctional between the hypothalamus and the testicles, and you're not getting a normal testosterone production. And then for the female side, we will see some sort of congenital abnormalities in reproductive structures. So that can be a whole spectrum of that. I am not a gynecologist. Thank goodness my wife is. But you see increased rates of developmental issues there. And then on the kidney, we see high rates of congenital either kidney malformations, a lack of kidney formation. So like horseshoe kidneys are associated with this. People that are born with cystic kidneys. This is usually more of a multicystic instead of just polycystic, like adult polycystic kidney disease. We see a lot. And then also associated with bladder and urinary system abnormalities. So basically everything doesn't migrate because cilia are very involved in cellular migration. And so you get abnormal migration of an abnormal tissue differentiation in utero. That's why you're born with extra fingers, because your bones migrated in a different pattern. And then when your kidneys and your bladder migrate in a different pattern, or reproductive organs migrate in a different pattern, then you get minor congenital abnormalities there. So you go, okay, that's a lot.
Well, so the reason we are talking about it, people are like, what the heck are you guys? This is a genetic syndromic obesity thing we got to be aware of. So when people see these kids and they're like, they blame the parents for child abuse because they didn't take care of them. And it turned out there was a very strong genetic syndromic reason for that. And so Dr. Jesse here is an expert on it. And I think there are, us included, I don't remember learning much about it in medical school or during residency. Right. But as obesity specialists, we really need to be aware of this, because it will go undiagnosed even by, pediatricians, and it's not their fault. Sure. They didn't learn about it necessarily either. Right.
It's rare enough. And I think, I think that's one of the reasons we do this, even though it sounds complex to maybe the lay audience. But when people hear about it, they might say, wait a second. And, they might say, that's me, or that's my kids, or something like that. And so, just spreading awareness can sometimes, help.
Yeah. I think the textbook case that really got me, because I remember, like you said, Spencer, I'm an internist by training, trained for primary care. I did obesity boards. And I went, oh, I have to learn this pediatric stuff. And then I remember just like doing a flashcard that was like odd finger, odd kidney. And this is probably the answer. And I was like, I'm never going to see that in my life. And I had a patient come in and they were like, oh yeah, I'm like missing teeth, which was another issue. They're like, the retinal specialists don't know why my eyes have been slowly going blind for 20 years. And I was like, what? And the funny thing was, I had seen this patient for 3 years and the patient had had bariatric surgery. And I went, yeah. And started with a BMI of 67, almost 400 pounds, had a good response, had some like, you know, post-op issues with concomitant medical treatment, but everything was mostly stable. And I never actually thought to take a history on this stuff. And then I just started asking, I was like, well, you don't need to even test you. You don't have this. And she's like, yeah, I do. And I'm like, you don't have that. Yeah, I do. Well, you don't have, you know, like reproductive. She's like, yeah, I do. I'm like, okay, well, I didn't ask, so I didn't know. And then we ran testing, you know, had suggestive genetics. And the genetics piece is complicated. That's something that I see a lot of people get tripped up, because in the past, none of this testing was available. There are now, I think, 5 different commercial panels that can test for major genetic weight drivers, either monogenic or syndromic, including a lot of the genes for BBS. And while the large majority of people that have BBS are going to be the classic BBS1, BBS2, BBS4, there are actually like over 25 genes that are basically conditionally or very strongly associated with the genetic syndrome at this point. And so understanding and interpreting the genetics gets really hard, especially if you have, you know, limited access, because genetic testing is expensive and not everybody can afford to do it. And so then a lot of times that just leaves us with the clinical criteria, which is why I'm really honestly proud of the work that we've done updating the clinical criteria to help incorporate this and hopefully make the diagnosis in terms of what you need to be thinking about and where you need to send folks a little more straightforward.
Yeah. Well, let's go over the clinical criteria. That's like, and why is it different than what it was before and all that?
So the original criteria were done by Phil Beals, who's a fantastic clinician and acquaintance of mine over in England, based off of a population of about 100 patients who presented with this really specific set of features. And it had most of the same ones that we had. The issue is it was originally described in 1997. And for the younger listeners out there who may not be aware, that was actually before the Human Genome Project read out. So we didn't even have the human genome at that point. We only had basically point testing for one or even like 2 or 3 BBS-associated genes. They just knew this is what this really specific clinical phenotype looks like. And then we, over the past 30 years, have had an explosion in genetic testing, better understanding of the molecular pathways involved. And we started to get a lot more data from those type of diagnostics, but they weren't incorporated into the original guidelines because they didn't exist back then.
So now what? Yeah. So what are the criteria now?
Sure. So the major criteria, just to start with, diagnosis is based off of major and minor criteria. So you have to have 4 major, and if you have that, you're done. Or you have to have 3 major and then 2 supportive minor criteria. All of this is interpreted through the context of genetics. So if you have the clinical presentation, we're good. I'll talk about 1 or 2 rare exceptions there. But if you have the main clinical features, you're good. And if you have what is considered basically slam dunk positive genetics, we don't have quite as high of a bar. Now, the main criteria are going to be polydactyly, so post-axial polydactyly, reproductive structural abnormalities or hypogonadism in males, kidney or renal structural abnormalities. It's going to be early onset obesity, which can be associated with hyperphagia, and then neuroanatomical abnormalities.
Did you say retinal?
And then lastly, the part of the body I am least comfortable with, the eyes, Metten dystrophy.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So there's 6 major criteria. If your patient that you're looking at in front of you meets 4 of those, and you then, 1, you should probably genetic test them. And 2, you should be considering this clinical diagnosis, especially if they're relatively younger with age of onset for these issues. You know, like I have patients that come through that are adolescents, and I'm like, oh wow, your BMI is really super high, like, you know, 50 plus at age 17. And so we check and their testosterone's 900. They don't have hypogonadism. And I was like, okay, great. We don't have to worry about that anymore. Moving on. Or, you know, you might check a 19-year-old and their total testosterone is 40 and their free is 2. And you go like, okay, this is great. But again, if you don't think about it, you won't test it. Now, moving on from the major criteria. Again, we have to have 4 major or 3 major and 2 minor. Or concentrating deficits. So your kidneys may look structurally normal, but they just don't function normally because they're not allowed, able to perform the normal urine concentrating.
How would you test that?
That's going to be typically a 24-hour urine collection. If patients are something that's in as an adult clinician, this is also something that I will usually make sure this has been a long-standing history. So, for example, I wouldn't count chronic urinary retention if it was a man and it started at age 50. Like, that's very clinic. You would just assume that's going to be a baseline. But if it's something that they had diagnosed early and it's been present throughout their lifespan, then you would think that would be.
Do you see like a lymphedema? Do you see water, like fluid retention in their legs?
I am not aware of the data on that. Actually,
just have you seen it clinically? I don't know.
I have seen lymphedema, but it's typically going to be in the patients that are going to be BMI, I would say like 50 plus, mm-hmm. where you would typically expect for like a lot of like fibrosis and inflammatory changes, in skin and lymphatic system. I'm not aware of direct ciliary, implications, the way it affects the kidney, because a lot of that's related to the metabolic demand.
Okay.
All right. If you don't have extra fingers or toes, one of the other things we look for is abnormalities in digits. So that's going to be brachydactyly severe shortening or syndactyly fusion in the fingers. Now, in hands, this is almost always surgically corrected at a young age. Toes, I just ask folks, like, do you or your family members have webbed toes? That's just an easy
thing. How short are we talking about with the fingers?
If this turns into something about my sausage
fingers. I had a patient who was a...
No, I'm actually, because I have patients that I'm like, I swear they have it.
So the key thing is being out of proportion for the rest of their body. Like, if I have a 4'11" female who has tiny hands, I'm not as worried about it. If I have a 6'3" dude and his ball spread width is only like 6 or 7 inches, I'm looking at that and I'm like, that's very much out of proportion. There are specific criteria that I cannot recall off the top of my head, but they are accepted in the genetics community. Another one is hearing loss, because the ears require a lot of ciliary function. Laterality defects, which this basically just means when you look at someone, all of their features are not completely symmetrical. Another one that's actually really easy to ask about, but also gets forgotten, is going to be anosmia or hyposmia. Because that's related to some very specific neuronal cell migration, and the olfactory nerves are actually highly.
That is.
Oh, so basically, it's, can you smell?
Yeah.
So are you? I think the polite term is nose deaf. Hmm. So, and then
in a long history of it, not after COVID.
Exactly. This would not be post COVID. This would be something that you just your entire life have had a weak or pretty much missing sense of smell. Although I keep saying that, working in the medical field, I don't know if that would really be a disadvantage.
Right. Yeah.
So,
depends on where it was.
Other one's going to be dental abnormalities. This is going to be, say, like significantly impinged palate. So patients might have like required a palate spreader because their mouth was so small. Microagnathia, or they are actually just missing teeth. So like when they grew in, they actually were just missing. So hypodontia. Craniofacial dimorphisms I misspoke earlier. When the laterality defects is usually we think of organs being on one side compared to the other.
Like dextrocardia or something like that?
Yes. Actually, that's the exact word. Next word's out of my mouth. That one is not very common. I want to say it's less than 5%, but it is something that if it's present, that would be something you potentially think about. Craniofacial dimorphisms. It's basically like, say you just don't have a relatively normal facial structure. Cheeks might be protuberant, nose might be flattened, like eyes might be set in or out. It's just a lot of minor things. This is something where a lot of people look a lot of different ways. And unless there's a really extreme case, I would not just say to someone, your face looks odd, I think you have genetics. I would only consider that kind of like in the total clinical gestalt. And then the last one is actually going to be MASLD, hepatic steatosis. Ciliary function in hepatocytes is actually related to a lot of the inflammation and fat deposition, probably related to adipose precursor cells. And so you have increased fat and you have alterations in how lipids are processed in the liver and just have much higher rates of hepatic steatosis.
That's a tough one to me, just because, you know, obviously, right. You know, I talk a lot about fatty liver and the risk of fibrosis, yes. And as it's an obesity related disease. So, you know, goes strongly with insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, et cetera. So a lot of people with obesity, and these people often, most of the time, are going to have pretty significant obesity and thus are going to have obesity related fatty liver. And I notice in, you know, I'm looking at your criteria thing, and it has a little sort of asterisk thing that says it may not be counted as a separate criterion if exactly. You have obesity already. So that would be more for like people who don't maybe yet have obesity from this, like, right?
This is very much, and that's a great nuanced call out. This is not run of the mill adult onset. This is going to be for patients who may have some other severe major criteria. So you're not going to double count a BMI of 50 and hepatic steatosis. This is going to be, if you don't have that, then you should consider, do they have metabolic disruptions that indicate there's dysfunction in that, that same pathway? So we this was something that was a point of discussion back and forth with, you know, like the endocrinologist and myself, and like talking to the other, you know, folks that were looking at it from different angles. And we really agreed that that's not something that should be counted twice.
Okay.
Interesting. All right. Okay. So someone walks into your clinic and you look at these criteria, you either need 4 of the major or 3 of the major plus 2, do you say, of the mm-hmm. minor? Yeah. And you're saying that, are you going to always check genetics no matter what on these people?
Okay. So we actually have a genetic obesity screening scale that I actually came up with. And then we're working on getting it published.
It's the Dr. Jesse Richards scale?
Oh my God.
No. I didn't name it after me.
You sure have.
Goss, okay?
I'm calling it the Richards scale.
Yeah, we are. And, okay. And if I update the next algorithm in the future, I will call it that.
It will definitely be the Jesse Richards
scale. Great, thanks. It's going to be like footnote like 4,723 in the ACE on like page 522. Dr. Karnowski, this is the Richards score.
Yeah, better
so open. It's actually pretty fairly intuitive. It's you take the patient's BMI. So this is again for adults or like adolescents 16 plus. Pediatrics has a lot of more validated hyperphagia and other assessments. But for late adolescents and adults, I have a pretty easy screening tool, which is just you take the BMI, and then we use food noise questionnaire because it's a 5 question self report that patients have. It's been validated in general and obesity populations for basically food noise. And I take that score and multiply it by 2. And if the total is greater than 70, we genetic test people. So
you just make that up? How'd you figure this out?
I did it to where there is no combination of those scores that basically is normal and healthy. Okay. Food noise questionnaire caps at a score of 20. Okay. In an average population, you know, when you're looking at healthy people or even, you know, like run-of-the-mill class 1 obesity, people are going to typically score like 5 to 8, you know, maybe an average of like about 7. And so if you're getting above 10, you're getting into like, that's kind of like abnormal food noise. If you get up to 20, like that's really pathologic, which should kind of raise your index of suspicion for maybe there's a hyperphagia component going on. So we wanted to incorporate that, but also wanted to incorporate BMI because you can have hyperphagia symptoms but not have obesity. And so the average BMI, when you look at the clinical registry investigating Bardet-Biedl syndrome, is I think it's only like 36, 38, somewhere in there. Like it's class 2, definitely significant, but it's not, they're not all like BMI 60 or crazy. And so I went, okay, if you have the theoretical maximum of, you know, food noise, so like horrific food noise, maybe you have a lot of hyperphagia symptoms, and a BMI of 29. Okay. Yeah, you might have other syndromic criteria, but we shouldn't just test every single person that walks the door. On the flip side, if you have people walking in with, like, you know, BMI of 42, adult onset obesity, and they don't have much food noise, they just, you know, have a lot of exposure to unhealthy American food and an obesogenic environment, that's not really something that screams genetic. Right. And so I set the cutoff there high enough so that honestly I can train an MA to just do a basic screen. And if it's that severe, then we'll test people.
Yeah, I don't know what my brother does. I mean, I usually go like, oh, you had early onset obesity, your BMI is over 40. I'm just like, and also usually if they're struggling, if I think there's going to be a difference in management.
Yeah.
That's where I do it.
Yeah. And a lot of it's the history. And if we get into the whole hypothalamic obesity stuff too, that a weight history is critically important. And so this is for the patients out there too. When you're talking to your physician about your weight and weight related diseases, a weight history is so critical to help us know, is this a genetic thing, a syndromic thing? Did something happen? Was there a tumor, in your brain that we're going to talk about hypothalamic obesity that's kind of triggered that hyperphagia that he's talking about? That's not just like, we talk about food noise all the time where it's very common and it's a broad spectrum based upon polygenics, meaning a lot of genetics and this environment we live in. This is like life-altering, distressful,
insatiable.
Lock the cupboards. Yeah, we call it insatiable hunger, hyperphagia.
But, Jesse, you, food noise, though, it's like from my gathering of what my possible BBS patient, they describe insatiable hunger along with food noise. So it's not just thinking about food. They are like hungry.
Yes.
Too, which is different from food noise, though.
Yeah, food noise is kind of the preoccupation. You're just thinking about
preoccupation, thinking about food.
You know, but your followers on social media claim that Big Pharma just made it up to sell drugs. So
whatever. All right.
Which from a researcher, as like a neuropsychiatric researcher perspective, it is hilarious to me because scientists and physicians didn't come up with this. Pharma didn't come up with this. This is all based off patient self-report. Yes.
Exactly.
Patients. Yeah.
I remember, in 2020.
I tell my patients all the time, like, this is a patient-described thing.
Yeah. Like, this was nowhere. I remember when I was studying for obesity medicine boards in 2019, this was nowhere. And, like, the remotest thought. So.
So let's talk about hypothalamic obesity, I think, in a different podcast, just because we'll keep this one a little bit short and sweet. So what do you do? Like, do GLP-1 medicines work for this? The bariatric surgery, to talk about the treatment.
So we have looked at short-term bariatric surgery outcomes in our patient population. And the short answer is bariatric surgery works for weight loss. And these patients are at higher risk of type 2 diabetes. They have higher rates of metabolic syndrome. They have higher rates of cardiovascular disease. And so I view surgery as a powerful tool to help offset the cardiometabolic damage that's being done. It may not resolve the underlying hyperphagia. So we do have a targeted therapy, setmelanotide, which is a melanocortin 4 agonist that acts downstream in the brain on a lot of the central hunger processes. And the thing that a lot of patients have reported to me on medication is they'll be like, hey, I actually feel like a normal hunger, normal fullness kind of restored itself. Like, they can feel not hungry, you know, after bypass, or they can feel not hungry on GLP-1s and their weight will go down. But the thing that has been really interesting to me as a clinician was to hear that people are like, yep, I feel normal hunger, I get full. It just kind of seems to, for some folks, recapitulate the phenotype. Doesn't work for everybody, has side effects, hyperpigmentation, sexual side effects, and some folks get GI issues. And it is a daily injection at this point. But for the folks that respond well, it's really, really beneficial. And so we have a lot of folks that have tried bariatric surgery, tried GLP-1s. I'm very much not a one-size-fits-all. Like, I'm very much everybody's a little bit different. And so we just try whatever works. And I have people that, when you look at the adult data, Setmelanotide typically produces about 10% body weight loss in BBS folks. It's not as good like it is in HO or POMC or other issues. But a lot of folks feel better. And so we'll say like, okay, you got 5% or you got 15, say you had a good response. You have 15% of body weight. Your BMI is still 46. What do you want to do now? And so they'll say like, okay, let's do it with a GLP-1 or no, I'm going to get bariatric surgery so I can walk around at a BMI of 30 and my weight's not, you know, debilitating my life.
When you say they feel better, what are they describing?
That's a great question.
Energy?
Yeah. Which is actually really interesting because probably about a third of the folks feel sleepy when they take the medication. But it seems when you get, you know, hypothalamic receptor dysfunction, either through BBS or some of the other damage or genetic issues, you times get a lot of like mood or sleep disruptions. And some folks just report that they feel better. It's a really interesting phenomenon clinically because, you know, these are really, you know, how do you define feeling better on a GLP-1? How do you define feeling better on phentermine? Yet I have people that say that they feel so much better. And these folks, a lot of those medicines don't seem to work. And then they report that they feel better. And so the biggest thing for me is, are you guys familiar with this concept of like excessive cognitive restraint? Like you can be healthy, but the like amount of willpower and mental bandwidth that you're occupying to maintain a healthy lifestyle is not normal or appropriate.
High amount of perceived effort. Yeah.
Yes.
I know a little bit about that from my days in college, making weight every god darn Friday and Sunday miserable.
Yeah. I was going to say, I feel like there might be a little bit of overlap with that in sports.
Seriously.
I'm just throwing that out there.
The good news is Spencer didn't know anything about that because he just went heavyweight.
Well, no, I was stuffed full of pizza and I had to eat more to gain more weight. And that was the opposite problem. Everybody's like,
And then I used to get mad at you that you didn't eat enough.
And then he put salt in my cereal once.
No, but what I tell folks is that, you know, my goal in a lot of these cases, especially for patients that are reporting more just straightforward hyperphagia symptoms, I'm like, look, I want you to be able to have a relatively normal perceived effort. I want you to be able to walk around, even if it's not at a BMI of, you know, 24.5 normal. I want you to be walking around where your weight is not affecting your quality of life. And I wanted you to be able to walk around where the amount of cognitive effort you're spending day to day on eating healthy and being that is approaching normal. Like, that's one of the things that, you know, GLP-1s help so many people with that. For genetic folks, they don't always work. The ones that respond to them, it's fantastic. But for a lot of those folks, melanocortin agonists seem to be interesting, and bariatric surgery can be very helpful too.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, that's a quality of life aspect, a mental health, emotional health. When I, you know, I talk to patients, my whole thing is it's literally what's on the inside that counts. So it's not about the weight per se.
Yeah.
It's about their mental, metabolic, and physical health. And I just think a lot of times people don't think about that mental health aspect that's so critical for people just enjoying their life. We want them to survive, but we want them to thrive too.
Yes. Yeah.
For anybody listening, trying to understand, wait, how does this drug work and why can't I use it for, you know, just run of the mill standard non-syndromic or genetic obesity? What Dr. Jesse was talking about is that it's very downstream. We got GLP-1 medicines that hit lower parts of the brain that then
older meds,
older meds that hit these parts of the brain that then send signals to further parts in the brain. This drug skips those other parts. And the reason it has to skip those other parts is because of what Dr. Richard was saying, was the ciliopathy, the communication of the brain isn't working. So you have to skip the parts that are trying to communicate downstream that hits further down. And why can't we use this in regular standard obesity? Is there a reason why?
So I will say that cousins of this medication have been running around the peptide space for 30 years. Because it has tanning side effects, and some people like that. It's not something that is effective in general obesity. Like they looked at setmelanotide in my, you know, just diet-induced obesity model preclinically. I think it was like 2% of body weight. And then they've looked at a cousin of it, bremelanotide, which is FDA approved on under
Vyleesi.
Vyleesi, yeah.
Vyleesi.
You looked at that in a month-long weight loss trial in like a metabolic chamber setting. And I think it reduced food intake by like 400 calories a day, which is good. But at the end of the month, it only, I think the weight loss was, I can look up the study, but I want to say it was like 2%. Mm. But it just didn't seem that this is an old medication that works really well in these patients, but it doesn't like just fix general obesity because most people have an intact signaling mechanism. Yeah. It's with the bibisome with the ciliary dysfunction, your brain cannot receive the signal from leptin that your fat is secreting. So it really just does not get the signal that we have 50 pounds of adipose or 100 pounds of adipose, and it thinks you're rail thin.
Yeah.
And so it thinks you're rail thin and you're going to die of starvation when winter comes here, and it's divorced. Mm-hmm. So your stomach and your brain don't talk with your fat and sometimes don't talk to each other. And so there's a lot of dysregulation. And because of that impaired signaling pathway, if you're giving back the end stimulus in a pathway that's not as functional, it can be very beneficial. But it's an old drug, otherwise that it doesn't work in general obesity.
All right. Now,
there's newer, you know, this is like, again, my analogy is that like, this is like exenatide, you know, or a Byetta, or this is like liraglutide, so like Saxenda. Someone might come along and invent the semaglutide of it, and then it does something, but for this medication and the currently available ones, there's just not the same amount of general obesity.
The future's coming, but it's now as well. Very good. Hey, so if anybody is listening to this and said like, oh my gosh, as my brother said, oh, that's me, or that's my niece, that's my whoever friend, make sure you send them this podcast. Dr. Richards put a lot of effort into this new criteria. I think there are not enough doctors that are aware of it. So sometimes as a patient, you have to say, hey, it's possible I have this syndrome. Hopefully we'll put in the show notes the criteria in your paper. And there are options. Again, it's not always a GLP-1 or bariatric surgery works for these types of things that have some various defects in the brain. So very good. I think we'll do hypothalamic obesity in another podcast. Since my brother, by the way, do you get paid by Rhythm?
I in the past have been on Speakers Bureau for Rhythm, talking about the disease state of BBS. I'm not currently on with them. See other disclosures.
I just figured people are like, this guy's a shill, just like us.
Yeah, but now. But that, yeah, I was just telling Jesse how thanks to what's her face? Jillian Michaels, who called us chills, you know, after spending 15 years of volunteer work for academics and everything like that. I'm like, well, I never got paid for all the volunteer work. Now I might as well get paid by some of these companies for educational speaking. And I did one for hypothalamic obesity last night.
There you go. We'll do another. We'll make sure you do do it right on its own dedicated podcast. Hey, thanks. Dr. Jesse for coming on.
Mandatory shout out to Jeremy Pomeroy. He runs the Marshfield Clinic, which is the International Center of Excellence for Bardet-Biedl syndrome, and they have a clinical registry. So if someone does come across this and they are like, hey, me or my family member got diagnosed, please feel free to reach out. I reach out to them. We always need more data. There are always a lot of good resources to get connected with for support.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.